Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me, my beloved co-host.
back from the wars, back from the trenches, as it were. But it's good to be back. Mike Casentino here.
And we have in the studio with us today, too, Gary LeMaster.
Yes,
Mike. Good morning.
And he's promised not to say a word. He's taking notes on our performance. He's got a sheet of paper here, and every time we mispronounce something or make a mistake, Gary's gonna write us up. We have one of our favorite interviews on the show today, Sasha Obronsky. Want to tell folks a little bit about him? We had him on twice last year when his book first came out.
No, you go ahead. The name of the show is Democratic Perspective, and every once in a while we like to talk about liberal stuff and stuff that really that we care about. And Sasha is an author of 7 books, and Kant. I love the one title, American Furies, about the prison system. He's written a lot about American incarceration fiasco, as far as I'm concerned. More people in prison than any other country in the world, except maybe North Korea. Because nobody knows how many people in North Korea has in prison. So, how did this, and Sasha does a wonderful job of talking about these important issues, how this supposedly progressive democracy became the king of putting people in jail. And the other topic that he does so well. First of all, say good morning, Sasha. I know you're there.
Good morning.
I'm talking about you like you're not here. But
the book is called The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. And when I introduced you last year when the book first came out, I left the word still out when I gave the title of your book, and Mike corrected me sort of instantly. why is that the title, Sasha?
Well, because about 100 years ago, just over 100 years ago, there was a progressive journalist and photographer and social commentator called Jacob Riis, and he lived in New York, and he photographed the slums of New York, and he did this photographic expose called How the Other Half Lives, and it sort of stunned middle-class America because he brought to public attention living conditions that were really primitive, tenements in particular, many, many people living in one room, dozens of people sharing an outhouse, lack of ventilation, epidemic tuberculosis, and so on. And it's a classic book and provided a lot of momentum for policy reforms in the progressive era. And so when I was coming back to look at this topic in the year, I started working on it in 2010, 2011, and it seemed to me that a lot of what Riis was saying still held, and a lot of what the commentator Michael Harrington, who wrote a book in 1962 called The Other America, also still held. And so I wanted to reference both of those titles in my title and sort of put it as part of a continuum, part of a story that we've dipped into and then forgotten about over the centuries, but that is an essential part of the American story, and that is the sort of economic underside of the American dream.
As soon as I saw your review in the New York Times, and I saw the title of the book, The American Way, I thought of, he's doing a play on words with the American War on Poverty. Since you didn't just speak up and say, yes, that's correct, I'm going to say, well, that's just all in my mind.
Not really. I mean, the war on poverty is a central part of how we understand poverty in the post-World War II period, especially from 1960s onward. And I write a lot about the war on poverty in my book. Though actually, I think in the year 2013, 2014, that a lot of lessons that were learned in the 1960s and early 70s about poverty, we forgot about in the decades afterwards. And in a sense, it never makes sense to go back to previous policies. Policies, once they're done, they're done. You can't recreate a 1960s set of policies around poverty. But the aspirations to tackle poverty and the moral energy that was put into the war on poverty in the 60s, that's something very valuable. And I do think that we lost something when we lost thinking about poverty as a moral crisis.
Well, we don't like to talk about it. It is so central. It is so behind. You know, it's like it becomes invisible. You know, and like you mentioned, those other authors and yourself. That because it is so essential to so many other evils and ills in society that it gets overlooked. And yet, you know, I see statistics all the time, Sasha, about how the cost of one aircraft carrier could wipe out worldwide poverty, could solve worldwide poverty for 25.
Some of the priorities that we have in our funding are just completely insane. I recently read a New York Times article that over the next 30 years, the country's going to spend nearly $1 trillion upgrading its nuclear arsenal. And you think about what $1 trillion, what a fraction of $1 trillion could do toward eliminating hunger or towards providing quality education for kids in inner city areas or towards providing better mental health infrastructure in the community. There's so many things that a country as affluent as America could do if it put its priorities towards tackling poverty and social equity issues.
Well, especially, I mean, we I know we're going to talk about poverty, but somehow education, I spent... I'm working in a high school, somebody wrote a wonderful article. There's just not enough of anything. In fact, there's not enough of everything. It was in the NCTE publication, National Council of Teachers of English. But in any school, so many of them, there's just the poverty of not, forget about the students. That's a whole nother. But the poverty of the institution and the poverty of the endeavor is so evident almost at every turn.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was grappling with when I was writing my book, and the book's reported, it's not sociology, it's not me sitting in an armchair thinking about poverty, it's me traveling around the country talking to people who lived in poverty, talking to people who work nonstop around the issues of poverty and who think nonstop around the issues of poverty. And one of the things that I came to understand as I reported this was the complexity of the issue, that it really wasn't just about individuals, and that if you reduced it to being just about individuals, you missed the fact that there were a huge number of systemic things in play, that we were systemically underfunding certain parts of our economy, that we were systemically misusing the tax system in a way that was almost guaranteed to push money and influence up the economic ladder and make poorer people increasingly vulnerable. We were talking before the show started about the issue of sales taxes. And, you know, one of the things we've seen in the last few decades is that taxes on wealthy people, estate taxes, capital gains taxes, the sorts of taxes that wealthy people pay have gone down. But the sorts of taxes that poorer people pay, especially sales taxes, have gone up. And so we've seen this sort of total recalibration of the way the economy functions that's almost guaranteed to lock into place poverty at the bottom of the economy. And I think that understanding that is really, really important, because otherwise all we're doing is we're talking about a series of problems without really understanding their causes. And if you don't understand the causes of problems, it's very, very hard to work towards solutions that are going to make sense.
Well, that's it. Right now, Arizona, I would love to see you focus your laser on Arizona. I would love to know more about the poverty in the state that I see in South Phoenix and in the big cities and in the rural areas. Now, we live in a semi-rural area, I guess. Two out of three of us live in Cottonwood and not reputed to be as affluent as Sedona. And
the percentages of kids, for example, getting supported lunches in the schools is really quite large. I don't think people realize the amount of poverty, particularly as you move down toward in the lower part of the valley. I wanted to ask Sasha, what, because you don't know, maybe Arizona, but has anything changed? The book is now coming out in paperback in 2014.
I did download it on Kindle for $10. I want $10 and change, I think.
And The thing I don't like about Kindle is I can't access it, a book, the way I can if I've got it physically there. So it's hard for me to flip through the chapters and get to stuff that I want or to go back to something I remember. But
you're an amateur.
I have a Kindle.
Well, we can talk about the publishing thing.
What I wanted to talk about, Mike, was really, Sasha, has anything changed much since you started? What are the most significant changes that you've seen since you started working on the book?
Two permutations that happened. The first was while I was writing the book itself. And I started writing it when the economy was going just into an absolute tailspin. And as I wrote it, a lot of the economic numbers and a lot of the state data got worse and worse and worse. So I think the first permutation was I was sort of eyewitness to this magnification process. And then after the book came out, the economic recovery sort of began picking up steam. And so I think one of the differences is that the headline data is different today. So when I was writing the book, unemployment was somewhere around 10%, and especially in desert western states like Arizona and Nevada, there was this absolute crisis compounded by a collapse in the housing market. If you look at the data today, unemployment's back down under 6% nationally. The economy's growing again. The stock market, even after the last couple of weeks of stock market sell-offs, the stock market is still doing pretty well. And the housing market has largely rebounded. So on those headline data, the economy is going in the right direction. But the thing is, when you drill underneath the headlines, what you see is the poverty rate's basically not shifted. When the book came out a year ago, the poverty rate nationally was just over 15%, and now it's just under 15%. So it's gone down a tiny bit. But basically, this well of poverty has remained in place. About one in six Americans is below the poverty line. About one in six Americans needs food stamps to have enough food to eat. Still about 40 million Americans, even after the Affordable Care Act, don't have good access to quality health care. They're underinsured or non-insured. So when you start drilling down and you go below the sort of rosy headlines, you see that this legacy of economic insecurity just isn't going anywhere. And one of the things that's happened, which to my mind is just so sad, but also so predictable, is that when the economy rebounded, a lot of the jobs that started coming back were jobs that paid a fraction of the wages and came with less benefits than the jobs that had disappeared. So one of the things that we've seen all over the country is that the people who lost their jobs, even though they're reemployed now, their standard of living has gone way down. By some measures, about one quarter. They're earning only about 75 cents on the dollar compared to what they were earning. And that's a huge shift. What it means is that for a significant part of the working age population in America, the economic dream has just disappeared. And what's happening is people are becoming more insecure, more impoverished, more locked into a cycle that they really can't escape from than they were before the recession. And I think that's something that's hugely important.
The question I wanted to follow up on, Sasha, just what you're talking about, is why has there been a great increase so many ways? The deficit is going down, employment is going up, unemployment is going down, but it doesn't seem to affect the poor. We still, as you were saying, have almost exactly the same rate as we did before, and they're not living any better as the country becomes again a little more prosperous than they were when we were in the middle of a crisis. Why is that?
Well, I think one of the things that happened is the sorts of jobs that were lost were jobs that over a long period of time workers had organized around and had created decent pay structures, especially in the auto industry, the steel industry, the blue-collar jobs that were paying middle-class wages. And a lot of the jobs that have come in are service sector jobs, and they're not unionized, they're not organized, and the workers have almost no bargaining power. And so one of the things you've seen is that all over the country, these mega companies like Walmart are hiring large numbers of people, but the pay is $8, $9, $10 an hour. And if you've got a family to feed, you can't do it on $8, $9, $10 an hour. And I think that we're actually seeing a reaction against that in the last few years. From about 2011-12 onwards, we started seeing all over the country these living wage movements. And you see it especially in the fast food industry in the last few months, these series of strikes around a $15 an hour wage with dignity. And you see it in Seattle and various other cities, especially in the West, which have begun moving towards mandated living wage structures. So Seattle just passed a $15 an hour minimum wage, and that's huge. That means if you're working 40 hours a week, you're getting somewhere in the region of $600 a week, $30,000 a year, and that places your family significantly above the poverty line. So I think this is one of the things we're going to see more and more of over the next few years, is that people are going to start talking about wage structures, and they're going to have to be talking about those issues, because unless we're talking about wage structures, it's going to be absolutely impossible to deal with the fact that our economy is becoming more and more unequal, that it's working for some at the top, but there are an awful lot of people at the bottom that it's stopped working for.
It's true that, you know, like Seattle and some of the cities and states have made a commitment to raise a minimum wage. In Arizona, we're kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum, where, you know, the recovery here has been miserably slow. I think we're, you know, at the bottom or near the bottom of the recovery with regard to unemployment.
A lot of people making $7.25 an hour.
Right. You know, as Mike has pointed out in the past, that, you know, we've kind of had a perfect storm here, where we've cut corporate taxes 23 out of the past 24 years, passed that responsibility onto individuals, and then we've replaced it with sales tax, and now we're facing an issue where the legislature unconstitutionally cut the budget of
for schools. They cut education so much that even the court said, wait a minute, you got to put some back.
And it's now to the tune of, what, 300?
Well, for this year, 330 million, but if they have to pay all that the court said, it'd be 1.4 billion. And this is a state that runs on $9 billion. So $1.4 billion or $1.3 billion out of the budget to education, which is, you know, highly, and nobody can figure out, because of exactly what we're talking about here, the tax structure, that this is a state that wants to do everything on sales tax.
Yeah, you know, I was in Idaho a few years ago, which is politically quite similar to Arizona.
Yes,
it's very
it is.
Conservative. It's very suspicious of tax increases and so on. And I spoke to some of the people in charge of working out budgeting for the state. And they told me about a period, I think it was back in the 1980s, where a Republican governor had actually pushed through dedicated tax increases specifically to preserve education, because the kinds of cuts being talked about in the education system were so desperate otherwise. And that was a generation ago. And these days you can't do that. These days it's such a third rail that even to preserve education in many states, including, as you're saying, in Arizona, it becomes almost impossible for politicians to advocate tax increases. And one of the consequences is that we end up cutting public education to the bone. And that has a huge cultural impact, because if we're not teaching kids to think critically, if we're just trying to say, all right, look, we have a mandate that we have to teach to a test, we have to get certain things done, but all the frills, all the extras, all the art, all the music, all the things that round out a child's education are going to go by the board. What we're doing is we're progressively de-educating our society. And that has huge follow-through impacts, not just in terms of the ability of people down the road to earn good money, but it has huge follow-through impacts in terms of what kind of a society we are, and whether or not we can maintain a leadership position in the world, because a lot of the rest of the world is actually educating their children far better than we are. And you see that in measures coming out of Asia. You see it in measures coming out of Europe. And that's a really, really big challenge. And I do think at some point that at every level, at the city level, the state level, and also the federal level, there has to be a conversation about ways in which to just produce basic firewalls around education and other infrastructure. Because if we cut them to the bone, nobody benefits in the long run.
Good term. I like that, firewalls. Well, and then just to add to that, that I, as a teacher, I remember and see two, you know, students, a certain portion of students, that they get two meals a day from the school. I mean, they get breakfast and lunch from the school, and that is their food source. And when those funds are cut, then we're talking about not just education, but we're basic sustenance. So what's the answer? I mean, I know that it's a little early in the show to be asking this, but let's talk solutions here. I would like to talk more about the problem, but because I believe we shy away from the word poverty. It's hard to talk poverty to. Nobody wants to be poor. Nobody wants to be in that population, you know. I wish we could find a different term.
And many people in Arizona believe that if you are poor, it's your fault.
That's right.
That's what they believe.
That's right.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, and this, when you were sort of opening the show by asking me about, you know, where does the title of the book come from? One of the things that Jacob Riis was trying to show 100 years ago was that poverty was systemic, that it wasn't just about, you know, individuals, but that you had to understand it in the context in which those individuals were living. So in Jacob Riis's case, it was the urban slums of New York and other big cities. And I think that the same holds true today, that when we think of poverty as an individual problem, we oversimplify it and we essentially wash our hands of it and say, look, we have no responsibility for this. You're poor because you're poor. End of story. Whereas when we think you're poor because you live in a slum, or you're poor because there are no jobs in your area, or you're poor because your state is underinvested in education, suddenly the conversation changes. And in some sense, it's quite liberating, because when you have a much broader understanding of the systemic nature of poverty, then you can start talking about solutions. And some of them involve government. Some of them involve taxes. Some of them don't involve government. Some can be done philanthropically. Some can be done through changing the way we do urban renewal. Some can be done through changing the way we educate. But there are many, many solutions that come into play when you view poverty as a big picture topic. And in my book, I talk about some. I talk about ways in which we can fund higher education, for example, which we know helps people out of poverty. But we oftentimes make it unaffordable. And there are actually funding mechanisms we could create that would spread the risk, that would, in a sense, create a social insurance mechanism to fund higher education. And everybody benefits. You could do the same with public works funds. You could say, well, look, nobody benefits when there's an unemployment emergency and suddenly 1 in 10 workers is unemployed. And that's why a lot of countries, including countries like Germany, that have weathered the last few years economically quite well, put a lot of money into funds designed to help protect labor markets during downturns. There are lots of things that we can do, not just to tackle poverty, but to tackle the extraordinary levels of inequality, of the gaps between the very, very top of the economy and the bottom 20 to 40% of the economy. And we haven't done those in recent years. We've sort of stood to one side and watched as inequality has gotten more and more and more out of control. And we've either not talked about it or we've denied it's a bad thing. Well, it actually is a bad thing. If you take out the middle in an economy, you make it harder for that economy to function properly. And Paul Krugman writes about this in the New York Times. Thomas Piketty, the French economist who wrote the book Capital, wrote a lot about this. Robert Reich did a documentary on this recently called Inequality for All. It's really unhealthy when inequality gets as out of control as it's gotten in the last 20 to 30 years in America. And it's a conversation that needs to be had about how to remedy it.
Robert Reich has done a great job of promoting, and so have other organizations, of that Inequality for All. And we had a thing here at the library, the local Democratic Club here in Sedona did a showing. But it seems incomplete. It seems, it's wonderful, and it gets the job done for awareness.
But I think, Mike, people still blame themselves. They blame the government. They blame taxes. They see their wages stagnating, and they don't make the connection between the way the economy is organized. So all the increase in funds goes to the top 1%. And we normally have graphs here that, of course, we can't show on radio. People don't make the connection, Mike, between what's happening on this large level and the reason that their wages are stagnating.
Well, Will and Sasha talking about wage insurance, although at least that's my term, and he's going to tell me in a minute whether it's correct or not. We'll insure anything in this country. We'll insure, you know, it's like Las Vegas. They'll take a bet on anything, except for whatever reason, wage insurance hasn't caught on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'd use the term wage insurance. So I think, you know, you could create wage insurance structures, but you can also create public works funds that have pools of money available. So when unemployment rises above a certain point, you release that money into the economy, and you either create direct public works programs. You soak up the unemployed, as the New Deal did with things like the Civilian Conservation Corps. You put people to work doing socially useful things. Or you start providing subsidies to private employers so they don't lay workers off. Because one of the things is you lay off a lot of workers, and over time those workers become de-skilled. They lose their skills. They lose their connection to the workforce. They become seen as sort of old goods. And even when the economy picks up, the long-term unemployed find it that much harder to get back into the economy. If they're not unemployed in the first place, a lot of those problems don't materialize. So it's a sort of win-win. If you can provide these funding mechanisms to keep people employed, you benefit the workers, you benefit the broader economy because you're keeping consumer spending going, and you benefit private business because private business don't have to shutter infrastructure. So, you know, these things are sort of fairly common sense, and economists have known how to do them for the better part of 100 years. That we don't do them to a great extent in this country is a series of policy choices. We've regarded it as too expensive. We've regarded it as sort of somehow non-individualistic, as infringing too much on the prerogatives of the labor market. But sometimes those regulations actually end up smoothing out what's otherwise a very bumpy ride.
You said in your book about you credited Chris Hedges for the term America's sacrifice. We're willing to sacrifice our poor for some reason, for the reasons you just mentioned, I guess, for higher profits or for...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's too mysterious. It does benefit certain individuals, certain organizations to have a fairly pliant labor market. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about that in the last few years, that if you have people very scared of losing their jobs and if you have people very scared of losing their benefits, they will accept lower wages than they would otherwise. And if they accept lower wages, well, that opens up the door for more profit. And, you know, that does work. It's an economic model that works for some people. What I'd argue is it doesn't work for the broader community. There was a lot of, you know, after World War II, or actually in the last years of World War II, a lot of theorists were trying to work out how to create fairer social democracies in the aftermath of war. And there was a writer called Karl Polanyi, and he was an exile from Hungary. He was living in London at the time. And he wrote a book in which he was arguing not for some kind of revolutionary system. He wasn't. He was firmly a believer of a capitalist democracy. But he argued for a moderated capitalism, that you needed regulations. And he said if you don't have regulations, the dynamics of the system will actually cannibalize it in the end, that you'll end up with such an unstable system that you end up with tremendous instability, that you end up with tremendous wells of discontent and tremendous wells of poverty. And so he argued to moderate the markets. And a lot of economists after World War II said the same thing. And I think it's no accident that from the mid-40s to the mid-70s, inequality in the Western world was far lower than it is today. Inequality was lower in America, in England, in France. And then in the 80s, that kind of moderation went out of fashion, and you saw this sort of opening up of the doors of inequality. And I think in some ways we're still living with that 30 years later.
Well, it tracks with the lack of regulations going away and the inequality going up. I mean, as the regulations went down, I think that some of the inequality went up. So their theories after World War II were accurate. You need regulation. Unbridled economy is a fire out of control.
Yeah, I think that's right. But we ceased to talk about it that way. We ended up talking about regulations as somehow being the enemy. Now, the thing is, you know, there's no one size fits all regulations. Some regulations are clearly unnecessary, and some regulations are clearly overly bureaucratic and overly cumbersome.
Right.
But to throw away any concept of a regulatory structure, we need regulations. We need it to monitor the chemicals we put into the environment. We need it to monitor the safety of food. We need it to monitor the quality of education. We need it to monitor the safety of drugs that we're prescribed by doctors. Regulations, in many ways, provide the backstop to a stable society. We need regulations. We just need them to be sensible regulations. But I think we're not really talking about that in a way that is nuanced anymore.
Part of the whole issue of not seeking social justice and not paying attention to poverty is that this anti-government attitude everywhere. I was in a class the other day, and a student out of, you know, says F the government. You know, I mean, this is, you know, I know people whose households are getting, you know, 2, 3, 4 government checks, and yet they have this hatred, this visceral hatred, to put to the point where even in a classroom discussion, you know, they have this, all this vitriol against the very hand that's feeding them in this case at this time for this period of their lives. And I think that's,
yeah, and I mean that makes sense in a lot of ways, because if you look at the scandals that have bedeviled government in recent decades, if you look at the complete breakdown in public trust that has gone on, especially since the Nixon period, if you look at the ways in which, you know, a lot of people can see the government isn't functioning for them properly, that it's functioning in a way that perpetuates a lot of problems, a lot of the suspicion of government makes sense. But to then say that there is no function for regulation or no function for a tax code, that's where it gets a little bit crazy to me.
Well, that's it.
And that's where I can't understand, you know, how does a society function if you, for example, take away the regulations that monitor the quality of air, or if you, if you take away the regulations that monitor the quality of medicine, at some point it gets very, very dangerous.
Well, you cut money to the Center for that controls and moderates and follows infectious diseases. You cut their funding over and over again, and then you find out we have a terrible time dealing with the Ebola virus. When you cut public funding, has been systematically cut to public health, just standard public health issues. And what I see is a slow burn. These things don't make headlines right off until something really bad happens. And so we're going to let Gary ask one more question.
Yeah.
Because just don't let this interfere with your notes about
waving his arms and jumping up and down.
I have a you know, kind of a view of poverty, in that I grew up poor, and I never knew it. And,
yeah.
And I think that happens with a lot of people, and I think two of the issues that permeate the problem are pride and fear. I think a lot of people refuse to admit that they're poor, or don't even see it. They get by and they think, well, it's my fault, and I'm just going to keep working harder and things will work out okay. And I think when you were talking about the aftermath of the crash and what that's done to jobs, that people are afraid, you know, they're fearful that if they speak up about their lousy wage and their lack of benefits, that they're going to lose the job they have. How much do you think those two issues play into poverty overall?
Well, I think the sort of idea of not seeking help out of pride, that is actually a part of the story. And one of the things, I live in California, and there are about 4 million Californians who are poor enough to qualify for food stamps, but historically haven't applied or accessed food stamps. And you know, that's extraordinary if you think about it. That's a program that's been in place for half a century, and it works. And, you know, it actually does a lot to alleviate hunger. But a lot of people, there's such a stigma attached to the benefit that a lot of people just do anything and everything to avoid accessing it. They feel it's humiliating. They feel the bureaucracy surrounding the application process is punitive, that it's designed to intimidate, that it's designed to make you feel small, and so on. And so I do think that the sort of that sense of shying away from help is a part of the issue. It's not the only issue. You could flip it on its head and say, you know, why do so many people feel that shame? And that's because, you know, as a society, we make it very clear that we view poverty as somehow morally unworthy.
Until it affects us.
Until it affects us. And, you know, that was one of the things that made the recent recession so, you know, all pervasive, was that nobody felt immune, and that you could go down a suburban cul-de-sac and you'd see people whose homes were in foreclosure. And, you know, I talked to many, many people who psychologically felt that they were solidly middle class, except they'd run out of money. They'd lost their job, they'd run through their savings accounts, and they were living on the margins, or they were living beyond the margins. And I do think that when you get to a situation where poverty ceases to be about other people, and suddenly it's about you, it's about your neighbors, your friends, your relatives, and it's about the suburban or ex-urban communities that you moved into, maybe to escape urban poverty in the first place, suddenly that issue becomes more pervasive. And I think, you know, one of the reasons the Occupy movement picked up traction in 2011, I think it was, at least in part, it was because so many people felt that, you know, suddenly the system wasn't working anymore. And you mentioned the term slow burn. I think that's exactly what happened, that, you know, there was this slow burn for decades where inequality increased, where security decreased, where an awful lot of people were working multiple jobs just to make ends meet, or where they were borrowing money. They were borrowing off their credit cards or off their houses. And a lot of the poverty was there, but it was camouflaged. And then when the economy collapsed in 2008, it became impossible to camouflage anymore because there weren't paper value homes to borrow against, and people had maxed out their credit cards, and there weren't two jobs to work because nobody had worked for a while. And I think that's when you started seeing the sort of, you know, that's when you started seeing people who thought they were middle class for the first time in their lives identifying with poor people. And I think it did create a huge
shift. We had the Occupy movements going on in New York that, you know, for then they started counting the days. But on the corners of Cottonwood and Sedona, you had old people and young people standing together with signs, guys with Guy Fawkes masks on. So much so that the local Bank of America hired a guard. All of a sudden, there's an armed guard standing outside the Bank of America because people are demonstrating on the corner in solidarity with this New York Occupy movement. Now, it all went away, at least in Cottonwood and Sedona, but it certainly is not as strong as it was, but...
And one of the good things, I think, about Sasha's book are these portraits of very, very different people who end up in poverty. To talk about a recent article, there's a very good article online on Al Jazeera, of all places, about people living out of their cars in California, in Santa Barbara, where I went to school. And if you wonder why poverty is hidden, it's situations like that, people living out of their cars, you don't even know it.
Right.
I don't know whether their kids make it to school or not. But people are ashamed of being poor now, and they do, as I think Gary asked, they do try to hide it, and they do really believe that they're middle class. And I think the cruelty of our economy is if you make a mistake, or if you don't take the right path, you're soon in a lot of trouble. And so if you don't get the education that you need, you're in trouble, and it's going to be very difficult for you to climb out of it. There's none of the, as you were talking about earlier, Sasha, there's none of the high-paying working-class jobs that you can go in with having dropped out of high school and make a living for your whole family. And so people are stuck, and I think that it's very hard for them to admit how stuck they are, that they need help and that they need some structure. And so we have people relying on their Social Security checks who, as Mike was saying, hate the government, but that's their only retirement. If they hadn't been forced to save through Social Security, they would have nothing.
I'm going to read a little list of solutions from the coda of your book. So how do we fund some projects? Well, you said sensible, fair tax increases, raising the capital gains tax. And boy, I talked to I have a good friend that's a financial advisor, and he says, yeah, heck yeah, raise the capital gains tax. It's crazy. You added on the list, increasing income tax on the wealthiest Americans. Eliminate, like some other countries have done, eliminating the upper limit for Social Security contributions. Reintroduce it in oil windfall profit tax. Creating a viable financial transaction tax. That's one of my favorite go-to things is what they call the Robin Hood tax. Imposing estate taxes on large inheritances that are more in line with the taxes levied by countries such as England and Germany. We unstarve the beast, is what you said. And so those are all pretty reasonable things. It doesn't seem too radical to me. raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans and raising capital gains taxes. And yet political will, I mean, I guess I'm answering my own question. Political will is just not there.
Yeah, I think it depends on where, when you're looking for political will. At the federal level, Congress is totally stalemated, not just around tax issues, but around everything, immigration reform, minimum wage. You know, there are a whole bunch of big picture changes where Congress just hasn't been able to act over the last several years. On the other hand, if you go down a notch, if you go to the states and the cities, you'll see that many states and cities, and obviously it's regional especially, but many states and cities, especially in the Northeast and in the West, are doing very creative things around their tax codes and also around public infrastructure and around things like the minimum wage and the living wage. So I do think, it depends where when you're talking about political will. The other thing about that list, I mean, it isn't all just about taxes. It's also about what we do with the money that we have, because this country has a lot of money cycling through its system. But yes, the way in which we prioritize investments, we talked earlier about, the fact that we overinvest very heavily in certain things and we underinvest very heavily in others. We spend a ton of money incarcerating low-level drug offenders. We spend far less money trying to actually create viable economies in low-income neighborhoods. So a lot of it isn't about tax increases, but it's about how we invest what we have and what we regard as the commons, what we regard as sort of socially worthwhile goals. And that's a political conversation, but it's also a community conversation. It's a water cooler conversation. It's about talking with people in your neighborhood about priorities. I think we've been having that conversation. Again, you talked about the word the slow burn. I think we've been having that conversation now for a number of years, and it seems to me in the last couple years that conversation has picked up momentum, and that things are being talked about in public today, especially around the living wage, that 3-4 years ago would have been way out of political left field.
I hope so.
But we are having that conversation, and that does give me some room for optimism here.
Well, the other, you said in your book, The American Furies, you talked about that rehabilitation has gone out of the prison system for whatever reason. So, longer sentences, life without parole, all became the replacement, which seems certainly a really a negative thing. But when you don't have some sort of rehabilitation and you have so many people going through the prison system, we're certainly feeding poverty that way because they're coming out without skills and in many cases unhireable if they were in for felonies of different kinds, without some sort of visible rehabilitation.
We want to thank Sasha Abramsky for being with us today. The book is, Mike's going to give you the correct title, because I missed it a year ago.
The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives.
Still Lives. And it's out in paperback. It's available on different electronic forms. And what are you working on next? We've got about 1 minute, and then we have announcements.
Well, I just published a memoir in England about my grandparents. It was called The House of 20,000 Books, and it's coming out in America later next year. So that's my next project.
I read some snippets from it. It looks really good. It's very interesting. It's sort of an intellectual homage to
Lost Worlds.
Grandparents.
Yeah.
Thank you for being with us. Hopefully you'll join us again next year.
I'd love to.
And talk about your new book. We have a few announcements. Democrats of the Red Rocks is having a breakfast this next Thursday. I believe it's the 16th. And they're going to have Dan Allen Cochran. And he's going to talk about what Republicans want and why Democrats should stop them from getting it. He has a PhD in government from Cornell University and taught at NAU for many years. We're going to be talking about the propositions. If you're in Arizona and you know these crazy propositions with their phony names and bad description, we'll be talking about the proposition. Counselor Barbara Luttrell is going to be talking about the new jail tax. Should we support the jail tax? Should it be done by sales tax, or should it be done by property taxes? On Democratic perspective, next week we're going to have Attorney General candidate Felicia Rodellini. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.